The Bookshelf with Ryan Tuberty is brought to you by Eason, Ireland's favourite bookseller. Eason have a rich heritage of bookselling since 1886. In fact, it's probably where you got your first ever book, or maybe your last one, and hopefully your next one after you listen to this episode of our podcast. And stay listening for our Ryan Recommends slot, my weekly recommendation, where I'll discuss a book I've read recently that I think you'll really enjoy too. All the books we discuss on this episode of our podcast are available now in your local Eason store, or indeed order online from easons.com before 6 p.m. for same day dispatch with free delivery when you spend over a tenner. Eason, be inspired. Welcome to the Bookshelf with me, Ryan Tuberty, and a guest whose life story will turn the pages over through the prism of just three books. And they are three books that we've asked them to pluck from their very own bookshelf. And not just any old books, it has to be said. The three books are, one, the childhood book, two, the book that made them cry, and three, the book that changed their life. And so who do we talk to today? Well, propelled to fame through the multi-award-winning TV show Little Britain, my guest today is one of Britain's most popular writers and comic actors. He is the biggest-selling children's author to have started writing since the year 2000. He has published a total of 40 books across fiction and picture books. You can read his books in over 55 languages. He sold over 56 million copies worldwide. Good Lord, he can also add talent show judge, television presenter, charity campaigner, fundraiser, long-distance swimmer, and OBE to his many talents and accolades. With his infectious energy and unique style, it is a real pleasure, I really mean that, to welcome David Walliams to the Bookshelf. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much for having me. What an amazing and really a bit too long introduction.
Wasn't it just? No. Yeah, I'm exhausted already. We haven't even got to your first book yet. But were you a reader as a child? Were you read to as a child? Or where did books figure in your life when you were little?
Well, I was read to when I was little, before I could obviously read properly. And so I have very fond memories of that, which is one of the reasons that I picked the childhood book that I did, because yeah. I have very strong memories of my father reading Green Eggs and Ham by Dr. Seuss to me. And there is something so lovely about when you're sort of resting on your parents', you know, chest or something, you're looking at the book together and you're looking at all the pictures. And there's something about Dr. Seuss that, as much as it's funny, it's a bit disturbing as well. Mm. I always find it quite nightmarish. It's a bit like the Sorcerer's Apprentice scene in Fantasia, yes, where things kind of go out of control, don't they? There's kind of weird repetition and things keep building and building and building. And also the creatures that Dr. Seuss illustrates. I mean, he's out on his own, really, as in he is the writer and illustrator. There's not many people who can do both. There's like Judith Carr comes to mind, and obviously there are lots of others, but often there's an illustrator and writer. He does both. And as I was drifting off to sleep, these rhythms and poems and rhymes would be going around in my head, and I'd be thinking about these creatures. And it was an amazing thing to drift off to sleep,
yes,
listening to and looking at those pictures, because it sort of feeds, it's very much like you're having a dream, you're having a nightmare or something like that. So I remember being slightly disturbed, but in a, you know, in a safe way. I mean, it's not The Shining.
But it's phantasmagorical. And
and just so imaginative. And also you just, with sometimes, you know, if you're a writer yourself, you sort of think, oh, I kind of can understand how they came up with this idea, or, you know, you just got some sense of what may have gone into it. But I think with Dr. Seuss, it's very hard to know what he was getting at.
Yeah. What's the point?
It's so unique to him. And it doesn't really take its start from anyone else's work, maybe like nonsense poems or something. Yes. But even then, it stands apart from those.
Tell me about your dad. I mean, tell me, what sort of a person was he? What did he do for a living? How busy was he by the time he got home to read books? Was he?
Well, he worked for London Transport as a civil engineer, which means he was in charge of maintenance for bridges and tunnels.
Oh.
So if we went out there, she was like, oh, I worked on that bridge like that.
Really?
And he did that thing where kind of people used to do, which is they work on the same, well, he obviously his job changed over the years and he, you know, got promoted, but he worked in the same place for like 40 years or more.
Yes.
So you get the same train in the morning. It's a bit like sort of Reginald Perrin, you know, the same train in the morning and the same train home. And so things ran to a kind of clockwork. He got home And, you know, it would be like the cup of tea and a slice of Victoria sponge that my mum had made. And we'd go and sit with him and tell him about our day. And then later we'd all have dinner together. But, I mean, I did spend a lot more time with my mum.
Yes.
My mum worked as a lab technician in a school, but she had she had more holiday time because she worked in a school and got off a bit earlier. So dad time was always a little bit more sort of precious in a way, you know, because it wasn't there wasn't so much of it.
So when he was reading the story to you, that's where you drift to your head on his chest. And that
probably
lovely...
my mum read to me a lot, but weirdly, what I remember most is my dad reading to me.
You've gone with Green Eggs and Ham as your book from the childhood, and Dr. Seuss has such a vast, doesn't he, collection. The real cute one I always thought was, "Oh, the places you'll go," I think is one of the most
beautiful. Yeah,
it's just a real kind sentiment.
Oh, they're all magic in their own way, and he picks on really big themes. And Lorax is kind of environmental issues. Places Will Go is like the most beautiful gift you could ever give to a kid, isn't it? It's about what your whole life is going to be about. And then sometimes they're very humorous, like Cat in the Hat. I mean, Green Eggs is real nonsense. But I love that they fit together as a body of work. And I like also to hear that he was horrible to children.
In real life, was
well,
he?
Well, I don't know if it's true, but he had a bit of a big be like, go away, you know, that kind of thing.
He was like cranky.
Yeah, cranky, you know, like these sort of some children's authors had a reputation for. I don't think people do it now, but anyway, I don't know if he really was, but maybe he was just besieged.
It adds to it, though.
But if you go to, I can't remember which park it was. Oh, I think it is in Universal Studios, they have a massive Dr. Seuss section. So you kind of enter Dr. Seuss' world.
Yes.
I also love he's called Dr. Seuss.
Because like whatever weird. That is.
Yeah. So everything about him is magic. All the books.
You like the absurd, though. I mean, looking at your work and whatever about your children's writing, which is beautiful, but your own creativity is the absurd. It is off the beaten track. I think that's why I'm pleasantly... happy to see you pick Dr. Seuss. It chimes, if you know what I mean. It's offbeat. It's peculiar. It's the things I could imagine a young you reading, funny enough, or being read to.
Well, I'm glad my dad and my mum, whoever, I'm glad they chose his books to read to me.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, though he's been very famous for a very long time, it's still not quite exactly the obvious choice. You know, we did also Beatrix Potter books as well. I think my mum read those to us. But... this is a sort of, I know it's quite grown up in a way, because it's not cutesy. The Dr. Seuss world is not cutesy. It's not cutesy little hedgehogs and rabbits and things, is it? And as we got older, me and my sister, we would go to the library every couple of weeks, local library, which is still there, Bannister Library. One of the few libraries that's still there. I mean, it's so upsetting, isn't it? Because when you know a library's gone, you know it's never going to come back.
It's grim.
So we used to, anyway, we were very like, we didn't have lots of books in the house. We didn't have many at all. But well, we went to the library every couple of weeks and we'd all choose three books. My mum would choose it, my dad. And then I got into choosing for myself. And one thing, especially as a boy, often as a boy, you like sort of a book about space or, you know, a fact book, books about dinosaurs and things. And then I read Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And then that was my path to being a reader. And obviously you don't become a writer unless you like reading. I liken it to, like, you know, I'd like to play the piano, but I've never heard music.
Yes.
You know?
And
so I was also very lucky that I got taken to the library because the whole world of books in there, it wasn't just I had to wait for Christmas to perhaps get given one. And if I'd have, you know, when I chose myself, I'd just get Doctor Who novelizations.
Yes.
Which are great. I love them. I mean, and you know, what was the days before things were repeated all the time, so you can watch it. But you know, that's a certain kind of thing, and there's other books out there. So I'm glad I got a real experience of all that was out there.
What were you like as a dad to your son when he was young in terms of reading? Did you? Because I always think it's very dangerous with books. You can force them down the child's throat and the kid then.
Especially if you write them.
Especially read my book or we're not talking or you're not going to be fed. But you turn a kid off reading by putting too much pressure on them equally. So how did you approach that and books that you read, or how did you pick them, like the way your folks picked Dr.
Well,
Seuss?
Well, my son Alfred is 10 now. So we've been, you know, enjoying books really his whole life. I mean, I'm lucky. I could buy lots of different books from him, know lots of authors. Julia Donaldson was an absolute favourite of his growing up. And
so that's the Gruffalo and the
Well, there are Snail and the Whale. They're all brilliant. And she's so clever. I mean, she started off writing songs for Playaway.
Did she?
Have Playaway?
Yes, I did. Playaway, Brian Cant.
And so it was a kind of, if anyone doesn't know, it was like a musical sort of comedy show for kids, wasn't it? And so, well, she's a brilliant writer. And also there's lots of humour and lots of opportunity for voices and things like that. I mean, there's one I read to him a lot called The Cook and the King.
Yes.
Which is not one of our most famous. But there's a character, there's a chef called Wobbly Bob, who the king asked him to cook a certain thing. And Wobbly Bob always goes, I'm scared. I'm terribly scared. And then he says that like about five or six times during the book. And then each time he's about to start, I go, I'm scared. It would get longer. I'm scared. And I do it longer and longer each time. And he loved it. And the other day I said, well, maybe we know we should give some of your books away. He said, well, not The Cook and the King. And I went, yeah, no, I'll keep that because you'll probably read that to your child one day.
Lovely.
So obviously I have a lot of fun reading them. But the other thing he used to do is, as I put him into bed at night, he'd go, Daddy, can you make up a story for me?
Right.
And I'd go, okay, what do you want in the story? He goes, I want Granny. I want my cousin Frankie. I want Batman. I want a shark. aliens, whatever. And I would just, on the spur of the moment,
lovely,
have to come up with a story for him. That was about 10 minutes long. And I'd have to be really kind of fluent with it, if you know what I mean. It would have to feel like a written story.
And believable, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, they weren't all great, but it was a fun thing to do and a good test of imagination. And then there are stories they want to return to. But I think is when they're very young, you just know they're happy to have the same story every night or there's a selection of a few that they love. And then you kind of, in a way, you realize the sort of which are the really great ones, you know, that are out there because, you know, okay, I get this. You know, like the Gruffalo, you can read that over and over again, and it's absolutely brilliant. So,
did you do the voices for all the characters in each? Like for the Gruffalo, there's all these lovely characters, probably six solid characters in there.
The Gruffalo was like that. I mean, I'm not the best at voices, but I did put them on, yeah. And he liked that. But some of them are very young, they look at you like that because he couldn't really understand how I could do voices and used to find it. You know, the other thing about kids is, because they're kids, they don't know all the jokes that are already sort of out there.
I'm still at the Gruffalo sounding like an EastEnders barman.
Oh, like that. Yeah, I'm the Gruffalo. And he's played by Ray Winston.
Yeah.
And anyway, I would sit with often my dog on my lap and go, oi, oi, like that. And I would go, oi, eat your Rice Krispies or something like that. And he found that hilarious. Like, so many people have done the voices of animals, but he'd never seen him before. So he thought he was great. So I think there's so much fun you can have around reading and books with kids. And I love those books. There's one Benji Davis book called The Storm Whale. It's wonderful. It's about a boy who finds a little sort of a whale calf washed up on the beach, and then he puts it in the bath to save it, and then his dad, so a fisherman, finds it and they, you know, set it free out of sea. But there's one thing is that they have six cats. They live with six cats. And so on every page, there are six cats, but you have to, you know, be able to spot them. So you go, well, there's cat one there, cat two. And that's just a really fun thing to do with them, which is really not very much to do with the story at all, but it's just a fun visual thing. And so, you know, it's not like a quick read. You can spend quite a while, even with a book that doesn't have that many words. So I loved reading like Green Eggs to Ham to him. So, you know, revisiting ones I loved and also finding a whole load of new books that I'd never read before.
It reminded me of when my daughters were very young. And I think anyone listening to this podcast will be going, okay, when you're a parent and you're working hard and you're exhausted and you look at the
bookshelves. Yeah, one day a week for you, yeah.
And yeah. I remember every first Saturday and you'd pick the book off the shelf that was the shortest one just because you're too tired and the Gruffalo, and then you're hoping you're asleep yet now and then as they get older they go, I want that one, you go, oh,
really long one,
and it's the longer one, you know, it's there's a selfishness to the books chosen sometimes,
but there's a lovely routine if you're lucky enough to be a parent, and then between about, like, when they're young, between about 4, 5 and 7, it's like dinner time, it's bath time, pajamas time, story time, bedtime. It's just lovely.
Yeah.
And it, and even now that my son's 10, you know, when I have him, I won't go out when I have him. And also, you know, I sometimes get offers of sort of jobs in the theatre and stuff like that. But I just think I find it so heartbreaking not to be there.
Yeah.
When he goes to bed, because I think when kids go to bed that's and they're the young, you need to be there. They need to know you're there for them. You know, it's not going out, are you, Daddy? No, I'm just going to be downstairs if you need me. You know, and all that kind of. They need that security, yeah. I think. If you can give it to
them. It's back to that lovely description of you and you know, on your dad's and his chest
or whatever,
the breathing and Dr. Seuss, and that's lovely surrealism as a kind of portal to your dream time. You know, it's really quite nice.
Yeah, that's why I think why Dr. Seuss is so special at bedtime.
Let's move on to book number two. David Walliams, you have gone for obviously a book that made you cry and a book that changed your life. I'm going to go with the book that changed your life for book two today. Before we do that, let me ask you about books as an emotional emotionally moving phenomenon for you. Do you find yourself getting deeply involved in a book, or do you have that distance that says
no? I get very deeply involved, and also it's very strange. People think this is very indulgent, but when I've written my own books and there's a sad bit, I get really emotional then, which is strange because I know it's not real and I know I'm just making it up. But if I feel the emotion is true and it resonates with me, I've been crying writing my books. I imagine people cry when they have to read them, but no, I've actually cried in sort of sad bits.
What's happening?
Gangster Granny. I don't know, because it's got to be true to you, and it's got to resonate something to do with your life. I mean, you know, people often say write what you know.
Yes,
but I can't remember who said it, but they said write what you feel, and I thought, yeah, that's. I think it's probably a much better description. So, you know, you can write something fantastical. You could write, you know, something in a fantasy land or something. But if the emotions are true, then it's authentic. You know what I mean? I mean, I wouldn't just want to write about my life. And certain things in The Boy in the Dress, when the dad is really proud of Dennis, his son, he sort of secretly watches him play football in the last football match and sees... how brilliant he is and how he's triumphed wearing the dress with all his comrades also wearing dresses. And so that bit always gets me too. And it was staged as a musical by the Royal Shakespeare Company. I used to watch that and cry as well. I mean, you know, I'm not crying all the time,
no.
But it's just weird to somehow be affected by something that you know is fictional because you yourself made it up. But there you go. It obviously resonates on a deeper level with me.
Yeah, and you mentioned it just very briefly, you said Gangster Granny just jumped out of your head there. Is that something else when you write about older people? And
I suppose, yeah, I'm a bit of the age. I've lost all my grandparents, I lost my father, and so they are obviously huge events in your life, and you know, you're left with memories, and very simple things sometimes set off feelings, don't they? Like when I went to stay with my granddad and grandma, he'd always have Imperial Leather Soap. So when I smell Imperial Leather Soap, I immediately think of him. And I've got my grandma, she had this little bell. It was like a sort of little boy on a bell. Yeah. And she used to ring it when it was like, tea time, like that. And so I said, you know, when she was older, she said, well, I'm going to leave you the TV. I said, all I would love is that bell. If you can leave me that bell.
Yeah.
And I have that bell.
Do you have it?
Yeah. And so, you know, I see that and think about, I don't know, it's just, and so sometimes, you know, it's not exactly you're being maudlin, but sometimes you're moved because you realize all that has gone forever. And they are just memories. And when your memories die, then, you know, they're gone forever, aren't they? And so it's, you know, those things just, yeah, they make me happy. Sometimes they make me sad, you know, and losing... You know, losing a parent is obviously very traumatic. And
how did your father die? Do you mind me asking?
He died of cancer, so we had to watch him suffer as well, which was horrible.
Okay.
Well, it's horrible for him suffering, but you know, there's no good way to die, is there? And people say, "Oh, he died very suddenly, didn't get a chance to say goodbye." But yes, it was, you know, a few months of real pain for him and discomfort. So. All of that, well, you know, the whole process is awful. And then it takes a long time until happy memories start coming. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. There was someone said this thing, which I thought was quite interesting, about the day you go to a funeral And you're in the car, whatever, on the way to the crematorium or wherever. And you can see everyone else just is going about their normal life. Mm. They're just going to work or wherever, to the supermarket. And what you're feeling is so surreal because your world has changed so dramatically that it's quite hard to think, well, why are you all just doing your own thing? Don't you know what's happened? Yes. It's weird. You're just so in this very strange emotional state. And so, yes, I suppose when I'm writing Grandpa's Great Escape, when I'm writing Gangster Granny, I'm thinking about my grandparents. And when I wrote The Boy in the Dress, I was definitely thinking about my dad.
Yeah. I'm looking out the window. I'm still thinking about looking at the back of the car, of the funeral car in my own dad's, and thinking that very same thing, going, don't you know?
Yes, I know.
This great guy is gone. And how can you just be going in to buy bread? That's so mundane.
I know.
It's most unusual. You forget that your universe is just that.
Yeah, it does feel things shift. And I also think I used to have that thing where you'd wake up and you'd sort of for 10 seconds, you'd think they were still there or something. Yeah. And then you find yourself doing very mundane things. You're cleaning your teeth, you're eating a piece of toast, whatever, and you can't. Even that all feels different. It's very, very, very. It basically just puts your world kind of out of access.
Yeah, it's just like someone flicked the globe and everything's changed. And actually, your landscape in your daily life is littered with landmines of emotional kind of tripwires to. Oh God! And you suddenly find, hold it together, because no one else cares, and I certainly doesn't understand why you're suddenly having a moment, and because you saw. Packet of silk or purple that reminds you of your father or something like that. Yeah. It's bizarre, but that informs you. It informs you as a person, doesn't it? Then as a writer, a broadcaster, whatever it might be, people listening in, it should help you with empathy. It should help you nourish who you are as a human being.
Oh, completely. And if you lucky enough to be an author and sort of share these kind of feelings, even if they're not, exactly accurate representations of your life, but they are, you know, they're emotionally true.
Yes.
And I think that is a great way of sort of processing that. And also, I feel like it's honouring them a bit.
Yeah, lovely.
Because with my grandma, I sort of think, you know, all kids go, oh, did you have a granny like that? Was your granny a gangster? I was like, no, but she gave me the idea in a way to write the book, because she told me all about her adventures in the Second World War.
Yeah.
And I was suddenly like, oh, God, she had a secret life before I ever knew her. And that was the sort of... I wasn't thinking about writing the book when I was 11 or 12, but thinking back to my childhood.
Yes.
Yeah, that was it. And in Boy in the Dress, it's Dennis is sort of, you know, he wants to make his dad proud, which I think is obviously a pretty common theme in a lot of people's lives, isn't it?
For sure.
Making your parents proud. I don't know how to write unless I can feel it.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know how to do it.
Because readers, much like listeners and viewers, in my opinion, are smart to... inauthenticity. I think they can smell fake. And I didn't realize it applied as much to children's books, but it makes perfect sense as you describe it there. And children are some of the smartest consumers of books, as you know. And they see
they're the most honest.
Yes.
They're certainly that, aren't they? You know, if they don't like something, they'll tell you.
They'll tell you straight up.
So I didn't like that. I didn't think that was very funny. And often they go, I read Demon Dentist. And I go, oh, did you find it scary? No.
No.
You know, it's meant to be.
Let's talk about the book that changed your life. You brought it in what looks like the complete poems of Philip Larkin. Hmm. Tell us about Philip Larkin as much as you can. Who was he and as a poet? And I know he's a seminal figure in mid to late 20th century British poetry. But
yeah.
Tell us about him a bit.
Well, he was an interesting figure because he was the librarian at Hull University. He wasn't from Hull, but he moved there. I think he published about sort of 5 books of poetry in his lifetime, and they were spread out. You know, there might not be another one for like 7 years.
Yes.
And so he didn't experience all the sort of pleasures that you might have of being a celebrated writer. You know, he lived in sort of quite poor circumstances. He never got married or had kids. He had girlfriends. And he used to sort of, I think, drink a lot at night, and he'd write, but he'd only bring out these volumes of poems, I think, when he felt it was right and he had something to say, which is kind of the opposite of a lot of us. I've got to write another book, you know, well, what can it be? And so I really love that. I really love that he was such an artist. And the other thing is, a lot of people are put off by poems that are full of literary allusions. You know, I mean, I like Shakespeare and I've acted in a Shakespeare play, but you know, if you're learning at school, you need to go, oh, well, this is a reference to Greek mythology and this is something that's from this poem here and this. And so it's very dense often and it's quite hard to decode it. But with Philip Larkin, you don't get any of that. They're very, very direct emotions. And also he's dealing with the bleakest and darkest elements of his personality often. And so I find reading his poems, you know, quite emotional. They can be funny at times. And obviously, even though they often have swear words, or well, not often, but there's a few with swear words, or they're about slightly disturbing things like him feeling that his sex life's passed him by or something, at the same time, they're beautifully written. So I think when you're writing prose, it's also good to read poetry because it informs your prose. It makes, you're trying to make your prose better, because great prose can sort of sing like poetry, but it doesn't often. And so again, it's that you'll feel, you'll hear turns of phrase in the poems or something that'll make you think, I wish I could write a bit more elegantly, you know. He's very famous in the UK, mainly, well, I think if you know nothing else about him, you know,
some,
the poem.
There's a poem about sex and the Beatles or something, is that?
Yeah, like, yeah, it's about the ban of Lady Chatterley's Lover and the Beatles' first LP, you know, about the fact that all of that part, I think that sexual revolution passed him by. And you know, so that's one of the things he writes about. He doesn't, it's a bit like Morrissey. He sort of portrays himself often in quite a negative light, which is quite interesting. But yeah, I mean, I've not ever read a poem of his I didn't like, and there's not a huge amount of them, so you can kind of get your head around them. And he's a very interesting figure in his own right as well. And he, I don't think, he doesn't come over very well, like in his letters and things to people, quite funny at times, but I think he had some pretty unfashionable views that you'd now think are pretty unfashionable, like political views, like, you know, some racist views and things like that, which is like horrible. But at the same time, he was a great artist, and the poems will survive, I think, forever.
Let me ask you a bit about when you pick up Philip Larkin. When do you decide, I'd love to read a poem now? What's your state of mind? Or is there a moment in a given time that you think, I'd love to read that now? Or is it just random?
I like reading poetry before bed, really. Yeah. I think that's the best time, because again, it sort of might inform your dreams in some way. And
go on, what's going through your mind there?
I was going to say that I have when I was married, I did sometimes read some poems to my wife when we were in bed together.
It was a romantic thing.
I don't know if that's the reason we split up, but
well, you had a child.
But you know, there are, I love listening to like great actors read poetry. You can get those,
it is,
know,
beautiful
CDs and things. It's beautiful. And so yeah, normally before bed. And also I feel like poems a bit like children's books in a way, you know,
short.
I mean, well, yeah, they're short. And great children's picture books often are rhyming as well, and so you can revisit ones that you like a lot. And also, even though Philip Larkin is quite straightforward, there's lots of literary allusions, sometimes there's imagery that takes you a while to kind of decode, or a theme that is not necessarily evident on the first read that you just go, I don't know what that was about. And then you read it three times and you go, oh yes, okay, I'm starting to get it now. So before bedtime for me is a good time
and
to read it.
Why the moving part? That is the question. Why the book that moved you the most of all? What is Larkin doing to you? Obviously something happening emotionally.
I just think he's so raw and honest.
Yes,
about his emotions.
So it's back to authentic.
Yeah, and he's also, you know, then there's not straightforward love poems, you know, they're about regret, a loss of a relationship, you know, hurting someone's feelings, whatever it is. It's not what you might expect. It's okay. Not, you know, shall I compare thee to a summer's day?
Yes.
It's, you know, we're in the bleak midwinter and something's gone, you know, terribly wrong.
Yes.
And so I feel that just has honesty to it.
Does it resonate, or is it purely a work of?
Well, I think it's true, and obviously, you know, all our emotional lives are full of pain, aren't they?
Yeah,
of course. No one goes through life without experiencing sadness, and so, I mean, they're not all. I mean, some of them, as I say, some of them are funny, but I just feel, yeah, they do resonate with me. I mean, I like sad songs. I like Nick Cave. It's my favorite.
Yes.
Musical artists of all time. You know, I like the Smiths, I like Morrissey, I like that. So I'm obviously drawn to that sort of thing. But interesting, he did write diaries, Philip Larkin, I think his whole life. But he asked his girlfriend when he died to burn them all, and she did.
Did she?
Yeah. And I mean, I get it, it was his wishes, but people think that was sort of the biggest act of sort of literary destruction.
Yeah.
You know, because it obviously would be interesting. But saying that, if he was very dislikable in his diaries, I think that would hurt his work. You know, I think the thing is, you know, he did have some views that are unpleasant, but I think it's whether it's affected, whether it's in the work, isn't it? I think that's when it becomes complicated.
Yes.
When if the poems are full of really unpleasant sentiments, then they'll become harder and harder to read over time, weren't they? But I don't feel they are. I feel his complications as a person, with his political views, I personally don't think they're in the poems.
Let's move to our third book today. David Walliams, you've gone for the book that, I suppose we call it the book that made you cry, and you've gone for Itchy Guru, who we know from Remains of the Day, of course, and Never Let Me Go, but you've gone for The Unconsoled. Tell us about the name of the book. Tell us about the book and why you chose it.
Okay, so the book came out in 1995, and it was after Remains of the Day had come out. It was a huge, huge hit. And people didn't actually like The Unconsoled that much at the time. They thought it was pretty unwieldy. And Remains of the Day is a sort of easier to digest, you know, the story of this all point of view of Stevens, this butler, and the fact he finds it very hard to connect emotionally with people. And how he's lived his whole life in servitude to someone who turned out to be, you know, a bad person. He was like a Nazi sympathizer. So it's a very sort of straightforward book, and it made it also an amazing movie with, yes, Anthony Hopkins and Emma Thompson. So The Unconsoled is a dream narrative. I think it was at first called like Piano Dreams or something. And it's about a concert pianist who goes to this Eastern European city and he has to play a concert. But he has all these distractions that stop him from getting there and playing. But it's a dream narrative, the book. So it's full of like strange kind of repetitions or things that don't make sense. Things like the geography of the city doesn't make sense. He'll say something like, I'm watching 2001 and Yul Brynner is in it or something. You know, those things that in dreams where, yeah, things are kind of out of order.
Yes.
And so it becomes more and more anxious as it goes on. He's trying to get to this concert. His parents, he's estranged from his parents who battled each other their whole lives. And so it's very important to him to play. So I found it just the most extraordinary book. And even though it's unwieldy and huge, I couldn't stop reading it. And as soon as I finished it, I read it again.
Really?
Because I thought it was so extraordinary. Interestingly, although people didn't like it very much in 1995, it got some sniffy reviews. It's now really grown in status and is now pretty celebrated. Anyway, I went to a dinner once and my friend invited me to, and I didn't know it was going to be there, but Kazuo Shiguro was there. And I was like, oh my God. And there was only about 12 people there.
Yeah.
So I thought, and I was like, came up, so I'm a huge, huge fan. And often people say that. And then I was like quoting bits to him, yeah, saying that anyway, you could see that I was a real fan. And very kindly, he signed some books for me. And now when he has a new book, you know, when there's the proofs go out,
yes,
he signs one of those to me and I get...
Oh, yes, that's very, comes, yeah, it's very generous of him.
Yes. And, you know, he's a global figure. You know, yeah, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And I just love, again, just this incredible artist. You know, he doesn't, he's not got a book out over Christmas, unlike some people. you know, a story comes out when he's good and ready.
Yes.
And he is fine with challenging his audience. He's fine with having things that are difficult. I feel like his books are not pretentious in any way, but they're sometimes hard to exactly understand. But he's not got lots of kind of literary allusions and things. He just, and he's got a very particular style. I mean, he's Japanese British, and I think this sort of Japanese sensibility was very clear in Remains of the Day because there was a slight remove with the emotions, which I think is probably something that British people and Japanese people share. That's my personal feeling.
Yes.
So there's often a sense that it's almost like there's a bubble around the characters and they can't quite break out of them.
Yeah, lovely.
And so in The Unconsoled, there's this, this pianist called Ryder, and it's his frustrations of trying to get to this concept. Really simple idea. I mean, it's over like 500 pages, but for some reason, I couldn't stop reading
it. Is it an emotional book? I mean,
I think it's emotional because it's that thing that happens in dreams that you're trying to get somewhere. It's
frustration.
And I remember this dream I had quite a few times, but I've never been on Have I Got News For You. And that I had this dream that I was booked on Have I Got News For You, but I couldn't find my way to the studio. It was this weird thing. And you've been to like the BBC or something, these corridors that go on these different studios. That's a really weird dream to have.
Labyrinth.
Yeah. So that is the sort of Poundland version of The Unconsoled. But I'm just saying it's the weird anxieties that you've got something you need to say to someone, but you're suddenly underwater and they can't hear you and those kind of things. So, I mean, dreams can be quite boring, you know, when people wake up in the morning and they say, you know, oh, I had this dream and start telling you about it. It's often a bit boring, but your own dreams are fascinating.
Correct.
And they're obviously pretty interesting barometers of what you are thinking and feeling in your life at that time. And the fact that you dream, you know, about people that have died, you dream that you need to reach someone that you can't, you know, anxiety dreams are very, very common. So I think it's an amazing sort of piece of work as a piece of literature. And I also think the emotions in it are true, and the ways he puts them across are surprising as well, and never obvious. And also, I just like the daring of it.
Yes,
it's so daring because people would have definitely wanted Remains of the Day too.
Yeah,
and or some, you know, continuation of that. He's like, nope.
And when you went to the dinner party, did you bring some of Ishiguro's books with you in the off chance?
I didn't know he was going to be there.
Yeah,
because it was a dinner for, get ready, Mikhail Gorbachev. So what I was doing I don't know. But I have a Russian friend who invited me.
I was going to say, what a bizarre
mix. And he invited
mix.
Some people to meet Gorbachev. Now, I get that the Gorbachev might have wanted to meet Kazuo Ishiguro. I don't think Gorbachev had any interest or knowledge of me, but he was doing like a charity thing because Gorbachev lost his wife, Reza Gorbachev. So he had a charity thing. So they were doing this charity thing. And then before that was this dinner. Anyway, look, this isn't my usual Friday night, but it just so happened that I was invited to this thing. And you kind of, you know, you think, well, when am I going to have dinner with Mikhail Gorbachev?
You know? Yeah, you got to go.
I don't think it was a significant event in his life, but it was strange. But, you know, obviously Ishiguro was there probably because he's the sort of person that would, you know, him and Gorbachev would have something to talk about. Me and Gorbachev, not so much.
You'd expect him to be there. You'd expect Ishiguro to be there. I like that you approached them, that you weren't, you know, too nervous or...
Because, I was at first. I was at first a bit thinking, oh my God, I wonder if I can speak to him. But I thought, well, I'm only, you know, we don't move in the same circles. You know, I've never won the Booker Prize.
Yet.
As far as I know, I've never won the Nobel Prize for Literature. As far as I know. So, you know, and I just love him. I love his work. And, you know, I love that he's been so kind to me.
Yeah, he's obviously happy to talk to you and happy that you were the real deal.
Yeah, and the quoting bits to him, I think.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, I worked once, it was on I did a Harold Pinter play. And obviously I'm a real creep because I creeped up to him by quoting one of his poems to him. And he was like, he liked me after that.
Oh, I'd say. So, yeah. Well, you know what they say, every kitten likes their belly tickled, and you're a good tickler.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. That brings us neatly to Astrochimp. I think it's only fair to say that here's your latest book.
Mm. It's not one that gets a Shigeru. It's his new book, Astrochimp.
Astrochimp, which Shigeru has asked for a signed copy of the proof, though not the actual thing. It's probably worth more as a proof. No, obviously not what we're here to talk about, but Astrochimp is your new book. I do want to talk to you about that, okay. Because, you know, honestly, I just love what you've done for children's literature. I've said this to you before in previous interviews. It's so important what you do, and you're filling those amazing minds in libraries, which I think we both agree are really important buildings. They're democratic, they're fair, they're free, and they're a lovely place for people to gather. And there's your books, like countless books by you, filling their brains and their minds with ideas and colour, the way you talked about Dr. Seuss earlier on. And now Astrochimp joining the mad jungle that you've created. Talk to me about that.
Well, my mission, as I see it, as an author, is to get kids reading.
Yeah.
Because once you switch someone onto books, then they're going to read more and you're going to progress. So if one of my books is the first book that some child reads, then job done.
Yes.
And Astrochimp, I wanted for a long time to do something that was more in the style of a graphic novel, sort of like a comic book.
Yeah, great.
I wanted to do something that was a kind of mix of the two. And the second thing was, for a long time, I was thinking, is there a story about all the animals that were sent into space in like the 40s, 50s, 60s? And there was a chimpanzee called Ham that the Americans sent up. And obviously everyone knows the dog Laika that the Russians sent up was actually a stray dog. So, and then I found out that the French had sent a cat into space. The first creatures ever to be sent into space were insects, and they were fruit flies. And there's a gerbils in space, all kinds of things, fish, everything. And I thought, there's got to be a story in this, but I wasn't sure what it would be for a long time. And then the book is basically all the animals are still up there. They now have kind of roles in a way up there in terms of like the Russian stray dog has become a kind of space pirate. The French cat is almost like a sort of Princess Leia kind of figure, sort of kick-ass character who is kind of policing the universe. The fruit flies have gone through a black hole and now they're giant and now they're the baddies. So I started thinking about it in a sort of almost like a Star Wars kind of way.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wanted to have this adventure and I wanted it to be really comic, really visual. You know, a lot of people who have boys, they say, oh, I can't get them to read. Yes. And the boys, you know, so I think that, you know, things like people can be a bit snobby about certain books, like my books, like maybe Wimpy Kid or Dog Man, these kind of books, but Bunny versus Monkey. Because, you know, I mean, whatever, maybe there's a 10-year-old out there that has read the complete works of Charles Dickens, but on your journey to maybe reading something else, these really fun books that you want to read for yourself, not the ones you're told to read to school, but the ones you just want to read yourself, you know, I think they're really, really important. So I just try and make my books as entertaining as possible, as funny as possible, scary as possible, exciting, action-packed, all of those kind of things. And, you know, I'm hoping this will be something that kids read for pleasure.
The last question of our chat today, David Williams, is to give us the name of the autobiography you have not written yet, as opposed to anything you might have written before. And you can have a little fun with this if you wish, but how do you feel about telling your story? Are you comfortable with it? And do you like to keep a bit to yourself, or where are you with it all?
I mean, in some ways, you know, you sort of think, wouldn't it be great to have never given an interview, never given anything away, you know, be like Philip Larkin, a bit mysterious, working in Hull University Library and not, you know, I don't know, he wasn't sat there on Wogan and stuff giving so your new book is out. I mean, like, that never happened. But I did write an autobiography, but yes. I would like, one day, I'd like to write a sort of memoir about being a dad. Because, I've had an incredible journey with my son as a single parent, you know, from when he was like two. And he sort of makes my life brilliant. And, you know, sometimes I've felt lonely in my life, but knowing he's in my life, I never feel lonely again. Mm-hmm. And we do lots of fun stuff together and have a lot of laughs together. I run up sort of like private jokes and things like that. And I was taking him to Disneyland because I thought, well, you have to go at some point, don't you? And we were going to the one in Florida, and I don't know if you've ever been, but it's huge and there's all these different parks and stuff. And I said to him, oh, look, we should decide, you know, what we're going to do because there's so much to see and do. But I said, I think we're going to have fun. And he went, of course we're going to have fun, Daddy. I'm going to be with you.
Oh.
And I was like, you know that thing where some kid just says something and it hits you?
Yeah.
You want to cry, but at the same time, they don't really realize they've said something.
Yes.
Because that's, you know, so emotional. So I'd like to write a book called With You, which is about my life with my son. But my son is only 10 now, and I don't feel I should do it unless he is okay with it.
What would you write about?
Well, I'd write about, I'd kind of compare my childhood to his childhood,
yes,
and the kind of themes that run through both,
okay,
and the times we had together, the, you know, the love I have him, how transformative him coming into the world was. And whenever people are having children, I say to them, I say for Alfred, I said, the day he was born was the happiest day of my life, and every day after that got happier and happier. I mean, it's not entirely true because there have been some bad days since,
yeah,
but the flow of it is it just gets better and better and better. So if he's 18 and he's okay with it, then I'd like to write this book. And so, you know, because it's, they would say, you know, with the child, it is the greatest love. He is the greatest love of my life. And, you know, he'd always be, I don't know, it's just the, everything I do, everything I decide to do has him, you know, he is at the center of it. So every job I take, I don't want to take any job that's going to take me away from him. Even you find yourself like speeding in your car or something like that, I go, I better not speed, you know, what about Alfred? And so we just have this incredible life together. That's a lot of fun. And I kind of like to share the amusing things and the emotional things with other people.
It's a lovely title.
Hmm. With You, yeah.
David, thank you for bringing your three books with you today and giving so much of your time and of your story. I've really enjoyed talking to you about it.
Always enjoy speaking to you. You're one of the good guys. So thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
For having me. You look a lot younger there than you do.
I look younger in the picture. Just for people who aren't watching this, David just pointed to a picture of me and says I look a lot younger in the picture.
I think you've got a lot of makeup on in that picture.
Yeah.
Less makeup on today, but there's still a base layer, isn't there?
Thankfully, this is a recorded podcast, which will cut out any insults to the presenter along the way. David Williams, it has been mostly a pleasure to see you today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So here's this week's Ryan Recommends, brought to you by Eason, Ireland's favourite bookseller. I'm going with John Boyne and Water. This is one of four books he's doing, the first being Water, Earth is Coming Down the Tracks. But stick with Water. Our character, main character, Vanessa, she goes to one of the islands off the west coast of Ireland, and she's really trying to get away from a serious story that's happening at home. And to do that, she just goes for pure escapism. But the stories follow her, and her head is wrecked, and the islanders are curious to know who she is. And so with all of that, you come across this little sample, if you like, of Irish life. Remind me a little of Donal Ryan, some of his wonderful books. But this is John, Quartet, Water First, highly recommended. It's short, beautifully written. He brought you The Boy with the Striped Pajamas. He brought you The Heart's Invisible Furies. You won't go wrong with a bit of John Boyne in your life, okay? So go for it. Water for starters. And this book, and all of the books we discuss on this episode of our podcast, are available now in your local Eason store. You can order them online from eason's.com before 6 p.m. for same-day dispatch with free delivery when you spend over a tenner. Eason, be inspired.